I'm Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City.
And I'm Gemma Gaudet from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho. Welcome to America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. We're teaming up with public radio stations across the country to talk about how life has changed because of the pandemic.
This hour, we're going to focus on food. Farmers are dealing with surpluses they can't sell. Many processing plants are facing shutdowns as the virus sweeps through the workforce. And consumers are dealing with shortages.
And we want to know what life has been like for you. Have you had trouble finding certain items at the grocery store? I think all of us can say yes to that. Are you part of the food supply chain and you want to share your story? Well, wherever you are, you can tweet us at Amplified2020.
Our first guest today is Mike Poshton. He is a hog farmer in Walcott, Iowa. He also grows corn and soybeans, and he's president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. Hello, Mike.
Good afternoon, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And you are a sixth-generation farmer, and I think a lot of us have ideas about how farms work that might be a couple of generations out of date. So can you describe for us your hog operation?
Well, sure. As you indicated, we have hogs, corn, and soybeans on our farm. We're a farrow-to-finish farm, which that means that pigs are born on our farm and they stay here for their entire lives until they're big enough to go to market. And then as part of that, we take all the corn that we grow and feed it to our hogs, and we take the manure from our hogs and use that to fertilize the corn. So it works out to be a very nice sustainable system.
How often do you send hogs to market?
Every week, we're sending hogs to market. We have on our farm, there's about 600 pigs that are born every week. And so about that many are going to market every week too. From when a sow is bred to when pigs are born and grow up and go to market, that whole process takes about 10 months total. So there's always new pigs coming along, growing up and heading off to market all the time, which is part of the reason that a disruption like this can create problems on farms.
Well, let's talk about some of the problems that can create. So you've always got pigs going to market. You've always got them reaching that market age. If they can't go to market when you've planned, what happens?
Yeah, well, you know, farms have been set up to raise pigs to a very specific size and weight, and that's the most optimal size for them to go to market and be processed. And so the whole system has kind of been set up so that pigs, you know, as soon as they're ready, they go to market, so they don't get any heavier than they have to be, because that's it's a worker safety issue, because you don't want the pigs to be too big, but it's also, you know, just the equipment that are at the processing plants can only handle animals that are so big. So when that process stops, normally we would, you know, be selling the older pigs and then cleaning the barns out, washing them and disinfecting them and getting them ready for the younger pigs to come in. And so when that stops, then we have to kind of scramble to sort of find enough space for these younger pigs that are moving up in size to try to accommodate them, because we certainly don't want to compromise the welfare of any of our pigs. We want to make sure they all have plenty of space, they have plenty of food and water, and so that becomes a challenge. And so farmers are having to kind of get creative and make the best possible use of the space they have available, and basically try to find a way to take good care of all these pigs and hopefully still get them to market eventually.
Well, I want to underscore just what a precision operation this is. You have timed out exactly when these pigs are supposed to go to market, and when they go to the processing plant, the line there is set up for pigs that are a specific size. So, you know, I think a lot of people are thinking, well, you know, send them in a few weeks when it's okay to send them, or, you know, hang on to them for a while. They actually can't go through the same system if you wait too long.
That's correct. It varies depending on the different facilities, but in general, you know, once a pig gets to about 350 pounds, then it just physically can't be handled anymore. And so what a lot of farmers, myself included, have done is we've changed the ingredients in the feed that we're feeding to our pigs to try to put them on a little bit of a diet and slow them down and try to get them to not grow as fast as they normally would. And so that the goal for that is to just try to keep them from getting too big, but you know, that's okay for a while, but then, you know, as we just spoke about, the problem is you've got other pigs that are still coming along behind them. So we've actually got quite a few pigs on kind of a little bit of a diet here to try to slow them all down a little bit, but you know, it's only going to work for so long, and eventually we're just going to run out of space. So, you know, I think the goal for every producer is to make sure every animal we raise gets used for food. I mean, that's the whole reason we're doing what we're doing, is to provide, you know, safe and healthy food for people. And so we're doing everything we can at this point to try to make sure that still happens.
Well, and I want to ask you before we go to one of our callers, and we do have a number of people already on the lines. We have heard talk in the news about the possibility that farmers might have to euthanize their pigs. And a lot of people are really horrified by that idea that we've raised these pigs for food, but then the food would just be thrown away. Is that something that you're facing, the possibility that you'll have to euthanize pigs because you can't send them to market?
Yeah, you know, even just talking about that just makes me feel sick to my stomach, and most producers are the same way. It's something, you know, believe me, we're going to do everything in our power to prevent that from happening, and we're going to do whatever it takes to put that off for as long as possible. But, you know, the unfortunate reality is that we kind of have to start to get a plan in place if it does come to that, because the only reason that would happen is if we could no longer guarantee the welfare of our animals, if, you know, they become too crowded and we can't care for them properly and keep our high standards that we normally have. You know, that's the only situation that would happen, because at that point, you know, it's not fair to the animals if they would have to suffer because there's not enough space available or something like that. So, you know, it's an absolute last resort that you know, we're all hoping that it doesn't come to that. But the sad reality is, you know, we already have, you know, possibly over a million pigs that are backed up on farms right now that should have gone to market over the last 3 to 4 weeks. So just the scale of this disruption is what's creating the problems. You know, farmers are doing whatever they can. They're selling pigs on Facebook. They're donating to the food banks. They're, you know, working with local hunters who want to process their own pigs. Or, you know, we're doing whatever possibly we can to make sure these pigs still get into the food supply.
Mike, stay with us. Mike Poshton is a hog farmer in Walcott, Iowa. He raises pigs. He also grows corn and soybeans.
And you're listening to America Amplified. I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio, along with my co-host, Charity Nebbe, from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. We want to take a caller right now, Janet from Tucson. Janet, tell us about what you're experiencing where you are living.
Hi. Thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for letting me be on the air. Tucson, I haven't seen any meat shortages yet, but I'm not worried about it because a lot of the meat that I buy, even though I'm not Muslim and I don't practice kosher eating, comes from the Mediterranean stores, which all has halal meat. So they do their own butchering. And, of course, there's not going to be any pork, but they have beef, they have lamb, they have chicken, they have goat. And it's all really, really good quality meat.
That's a really interesting
Mediterranean poppy. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, Janet, that's a really good point that you bring up, though, is where you're able to find that meat. So appreciate you calling in and giving us your perspective on that. Mike, this is Gemma Gaudet from Boise State Public Radio. So I'm curious about that. As Janet just mentioned, I mean, she's finding basically small, you know, local butchers. But how does that play into, you know, bigger productions?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And that's certainly an outlet that's being utilized. At least in Iowa and the surrounding states, most of the small local butcher shops are already booked out through the end of this year and into next year because, that system has already been overwhelmed by farmers trying to get pigs into the food supply. So it certainly is a viable option, and it's being utilized to the fullest extent. I'm even aware of some pigs from Iowa that have been shipped all the way over to New York State to be processed and distributed to the food banks out there. So, you know, we're looking under every rock for every possible way to get pigs processed. It all comes back to what I mentioned earlier about just the scale of the disruption. It's just so many pigs that, you know, it's just not something that's able to be absorbed by these other channels of processing.
Well, and Mike, let's look into the future because, of course, we'll talk more about meat processing a little bit later on, and so many meat processing workers have been just affected in really terrible ways by this virus, and a lot of plants have been closed. Maybe they're opening back up, but they have less production potential because they are putting in plans for safety. When in 20 seconds, when you look to the future, what do you see?
Well, it's certainly a possibility that the amount of pigs we raise is going to have to decrease if there's not going to be enough processing capacity for what's being raised. So that, you know, that's a very real possibility for the future. Could also be that we see a resurgence in local smaller processors as well. So there's, you know, lots of different things could change when all this is said and done.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for being here today. Mike Poshton is a hog farmer in Walcott, Iowa. He's also president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. We'd love to hear from you this hour. Tweet us at Amplified2020. We will be right back. This is America Amplified.
Welcome back. I'm Gemma Gaudet from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho.
And I'm Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. This is America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. And we're talking this hour about how our food supply has been affected by the pandemic, from producers to your dinner plate and every step along the way.
And wherever you are, we want to hear from you. If you're involved in food production, processing, maybe transportation, even sales, how has this pandemic changed your work? We are all shopping a little bit differently these days. But as a consumer, what worries you the most about the challenges that are facing our food system? Tweet us at Amplified2020.
First, we're going to hear from two fourth-generation seed farmers in Healy. It's a small western Kansas town of about 1,700 people, about how the pandemic is affecting their livelihood.
My name is Vance M. Key.
My name is Louise M. Key.
We farm out here in Lane County in the high plains of western Kansas. The M. Keys homesteaded out here in 1885.
We farm dry land, certified seed wheat, rye, triticale, grain sorghum. And we got our corn crop up, and it's coming up great.
Coming up and looking good.
Farmers have always been dealt with a lot of uncertainty. Some people say out here, we don't need to go to casinos because farmers are the biggest gamblers of all. But we got it dealt to us in spades this go round with this COVID-19 virus.
One of the nice things about western Kansas, we live in a sparsely populated area. Out here, our population density is 2.3 people per square mile. Cattle outnumber people 50 to 1. In most of these counties out here, we have no positive cases.
As time goes on here, we have concerns about the supply chains breaking down. You know, we're coming out of the winter and you know, in terms of crop production, not much going on. But now we are going to need fuel, we need fertilizer, we need herbicides.
Labor is a huge issue. We hire a lot of work done. A lot of custom harvesters, for instance, rely on foreign workers, and a lot of those H-2A workers never made it here to the United States.
In farming, it is just critical that you get jobs done on time. And then there's this other burning issue that is really bigger than the virus, is we got a drought going on. I mean, we need rain. If we could buy a rain, we gladly would.
Now, I guess what you're saying, Louise, is you're just out of luck, right?
Well, or up a creek without a paddle. At this point, you know, we need a plan B as well as a plan C for most things that we took for granted back in the good old days.
That audio diary came to us from Kansas News Service reporter Corinne Boyer. You can call us and join our conversation here on America Amplified. What has life been like for you? Are you having trouble finding certain items in the grocery store? Are you part of this food supply chain and would like to tell us about your story, how your work has changed? Tweet us at Amplified2020.
And, you know, Charity, you're in Iowa, I'm in Idaho. They actually are two different states, just in case people are wondering. Yes. if you're listening from other areas.
And totally different from Ohio.
Yeah, absolutely. Idaho's in the West. Iowa is in the Midwest. But with that being said, I think we've both noticed, just as consumers, some differences in our shopping habits. And you may have noticed there was a picture actually that went viral here in Idaho. And a lot of people were tweeting us here at our station saying, is that a real picture? Because it was basically a huge potato truck and people were grabbing potatoes and all of this. And it is, we're noticing here almost like a dumping. And what I mean by that is, as you mentioned with the farmer in the first segment, is you can't get your product to market. So that's what was happening with potatoes here in Idaho. They've been able to find like a grassroots effort to get those potatoes to people in need. But also we have a lot of dairy production here and dairy farmers having to dump milk. I mean, what have you been seeing in
Well,
in Iowa?
I will tell you that one of my first shopping trips right after we shut things down and started sheltering in place, I couldn't find potatoes to save my life. So while your
Next
farmers...
Next time, call me.
Right. And way too many. We didn't have any at all. We've seen egg shortages, and yet we've seen farmers with more eggs than they know what to do with. The dots are not being connected in our food supply chain right now.
That's such a good point, because we've talked about this off the air, Charity, is that when you bring up eggs, right? Well, there are a lot of these production facilities are used to, you know, sending eggs to hotels, to schools. And it's not like you can just repackage it and put it in the grocery store.
Right, right. And milk is the same deal. You know, they send them to schools. They either send them in giant bags or in small cartons. And they're just not geared up to send them any other way. So I hopefully we're getting that worked out.
You're listening to America Amplified. We would love to hear from you. This hour, we are talking about the food supply chain. You know, it can be really hard to understand how farmers can have just too much food and grocery stores having too little, as Charity and I just talked about in our own experiences. But our next guest will try to help us sort out how this system works and where we're running into trouble. Chad Hart is an associate professor of economics, crop market specialist, and extension economist. Goodness gracious, that's a hard word to say some days, at Iowa State University. Chad, welcome to the program.
It's my pleasure to be with you today.
So, Chad, we heard from farmer Mike Postian just a few minutes ago, and he talked about how COVID-19 is affecting him as a pork producer. And we are seeing some kind of stalling out really in every part of the food supply chain. I mean, so many of us, we are buying food at the grocery store, and frankly, we don't really think about the steps along the way. So let's kind of make our way back in the links in the chain. What other frustrations are farmers experiencing right now?
Well, I think, you know, as Mr. Postian laid out, the idea is that what we're seeing is a lot of the farm produce that is being created is delayed in getting to market and delayed in getting in processing. And really, that's the crucial step right now that's having the the problem here. We have plenty of farm production. We just don't have the processing capacity right now to convert that farm production into the food products we're used to buying at the grocery stores or the food products we're used to obtaining through restaurants and food service.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? And as Charity and I were chatting about with dairy farmers, and we're seeing that here in Idaho in particular, is that these large dairy farms are having to dump the milk. And it because I would assume it, you just can't make that switch so quickly from, you know, from having your product be, you know, given, you know, where you sell it to either a school district or you sell it to a hotel versus going and picking up a gallon of milk at the grocery store.
That's correct. Because, I mean, you know, each, if you will, level of processing is directed towards where is the end product going. And if you think back pre-COVID-19, the way in general our food system work is that, you know, here in the U.S., food consumers, we eat about half our food outside the home and then the other half in our homes. Well, given the social distancing and restrictions we've placed upon ourselves to try to minimize COVID-19, we have definitely shifted that balance. And when we shifted that balance, it also shifted the way and the types of food that we purchase. You brought up dairy, for example, and milk. The idea is that a lot of especially fluid milk consumption was handled through either restaurants or specifically here, I want you to think of the school systems. And so I think it was Charity that said, yeah, it was either being, you know, delivered in large bags or in very small cardboard containers. Now you're trying to shift all that milk into the plastic jugs that we're used to seeing at the grocery stores. Well, you know, there just weren't stockpiles of those plastic jugs around as well. And so we were trying to shift as much production as we can to meet at-home consumption, but we just can't find the packaging, the transportation. It takes time to rebuild and reconstitute that infrastructure.
And then you're seeing, as you mentioned, I mean, since we are, so many of us are eating more of our meals at home, you're also seeing that shift in demand. And a good example of that is a change in the demand for turkey. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Certainly. You know, when you're looking at turkey, I think most people think of turkey and they think Thanksgiving and, yeah, eating at home. But as far as the turkey industry, you know, when we look across the entire year, 70% of turkey consumption happens outside the home. Again, at restaurants or school systems. And so when those things got shut down, we saw a massive, if you will, reworking of, okay, what do we do with this turkey now that cannot go through its normal outlets? And so you've been seeing the turkey industry relook at, okay, how can we package for grocery stores, for home consumption? Where are the avenues where we can start to try to increase usage at home for turkey meat, trying to replace what has been lost with the shutdown of the restaurants, with the closures at the school systems?
Chad, stay on the line, would you? We want to take a caller.
We want you to call if you've been running into shortages or if you have experiences in how your job has changed, if you're part of this food supply chain. Lisa is on the line in Virginia. Hello, Lisa. Lisa, can you hear me? All right, I'm not hearing Lisa right here. She was mentioning that she's been to four different states and can't find a package of yeast anywhere. And I know that's something that a lot of people have been hearing. And Chad, that goes right along with what you were talking about earlier with we're eating differently. There are so many people baking bread now. Suddenly yeast is in incredibly high demand. So let's go now to Sarah. She is in Maryland. Hello, Sarah.
Hi there.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I have two. I get comments that are wrapped in suggestions. I heard on NPR a day or two ago about the euthanizing of the pigs and the dumping of crops because but I was very happy to hear the farmer say no, they are getting some donated and finding other ways. So that made me happy. But with the crops, I have family all over the world, and apparently in France, outside of Paris, they also have trouble with the H2 workers. They can't get immigrants in because they're not allowed into the country to pick the grapes and other crops. So what they've done is they've hired city workers, people that want to get out to the country and, you know, are within driving distance of the fields and are out of a job right now, and they're teaching them and hiring them to pick crops, and they're social distancing them by saying, you're in row one, you're in row three, you're in row five, and then make sure there's 6 feet between, or 2 meters, I think they say, between you and the guy to the left of or right of you or whatever. So that's how they're getting their crops picked, because they can't depend on these workers.
Using a very creative way to come up with a workforce when their workforce has disappeared. And Chad, that's part of the food supply chain we haven't really talked about yet. We are going to dig into these processing workers who are facing all kinds of dangers right now. But farm workers are also facing dangers, but also going to be in short supply. What are our concerns there?
Well, and that's the deal. As was mentioned earlier, and as the caller brought up, the idea is that we definitely do rely upon, let's call it, a fluid and mobile labor supply to help move our agricultural food system along. The restrictions due to social distancing to avoid COVID-19 are definitely restricting that labor from moving around the country and between countries. Because when you think about a lot of, especially our fruit and vegetable production along the West Coast, it definitely relies upon immigrant labor coming across and sort of working their way, not only just here in the U.S., but you see that labor work all the way from Mexico up to Canada and then back again. And so our food system is truly a North American food system in many ways because we rely upon that international transport, if you will, of labor.
We are talking with Chad Hart. He is an associate professor of economics at Iowa State University. And here in the heartland, one of the most heartbreaking parts of this pandemic has been how the virus has swept through the workforce at meatpacking plants. And in these plants, workers stand shoulder to shoulder as they process animals. Many of these workers are immigrants and refugees from all over the world, Latin America, Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe. There is a Tyson pork processing plant in Waterloo, Iowa, that employs 2,800 people. More than 1,000 have now tested positive for COVID-19. Other plants around the country have also become hotspots. And our next guest, Margarita Heredia, used to work as a meat processor. She's now a business agent with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Marshalltown, Iowa, based in the local JBS pork processing facility. Margarita, thank you so much for being here.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So a JBS plant in Colorado did become a major hotspot for COVID-19. How are things at your plant?
Well, everything, it's a chain reaction. Since our workforce has been reduced to, I don't have the exact number, but at least half or at least 40%. So our production has been reduced as well. As far as the, you know, killing hogs and stuff like that. So, it is bad right now.
And do you have an idea how many of the employees at your plant might be sick?
We don't have the exact number as far as to how many people has been tested positive. Last time I heard was less than 200. But again, we don't have the exact number since not all the people get tested. So we don't have the exact number.
Well, and I mentioned that traditionally workers in these plants do work shoulder to shoulder. I've heard people describe that they're actually often touching each other. And I know the plants are working hard now to try to put in some protection. How difficult is that in the kind of processing plant that you work in?
So unfortunately, that's how everything has been designed, and nobody was ready for this kind of, you know, virus. So I know the company is doing as best as they can. And since we have less people coming to work, so it is possible to move people around and try to separate them. It's not like 100%, but they've been trying to separate them as best as they can.
Right. Do you feel safe at work right now?
Not 100%, because when you go to work, you don't know when if you're going to get the virus or not. So, no, not 100%.
And I also want to emphasize the fact that there are some language barriers as well among the many people who work in these plants. Does the communication challenge also make this harder?
Yes, it is a big challenge. I know the union, they have a lot of different languages, and, you know, we try to communicate as best as we can. And there's also signs everywhere in different languages.
We're going to have to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about our food supply in the age of COVID-19.
You can join the conversation. Tweet us at Amplified2020. You are listening to America Amplified. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back. I'm Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City.
And I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho. This is America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. We are talking this hour about our food supply and how it's been affected by coronavirus, all the way from farmers to consumers.
And there is still time for you to join the conversation. Tweet us at Amplified2020. Tell us how COVID-19 has affected your relationship with food, or maybe you're part of that food supply chain. How has it affected your work? Economist Chad Hart is still with us from Iowa State University, and also Margarita Heredia. She is a business agent with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Marshalltown, Iowa. She's based in the local JBS pork processing facility. And Margarita, just before the break, we were talking about how closely people work together and how difficult it can be for these plants to put in safety precautions for workers, how many people who work in these plants speak many different languages. So communication can also be a difficult thing. I wonder if, given that a lot of the people that you work with are refugees, have been through very difficult things before, are living in a country that may not feel very welcoming for immigrants right now, do you feel like that makes people afraid to seek treatment, to seek testing, and to ask for protection?
Definitely. A lot of people are not very informed. So it is a challenge for people to seek help. And I mean, we are there to guide them as much as we can, but sometimes it is a challenge. The language barrier, you know, it's a big challenge.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the protections that you have seen put in place for the workers in the plant where you are?
Okay. Now versus before, now there's face shields available. There's surgical mask available. There's safety glasses, anti-fog. So there is, you know, more protection than before, definitely.
Have some of the workers talked to you about their fears? What are they telling you?
A lot of times when people work on the floor, and this is new for everybody, so a lot of times they tell us their concerns. So we talk to the company about it, and usually they're, you know, pretty good at working with the people if we hear from the workers.
So you feel like the company is pretty responsive?
For the most part, yes.
Well, Margarita, thank you so much for sharing your experience, and please stay safe.
Charity, we've been talking so much about meat production and processing, but the challenges that we're talking about, as you and I both know, they go way beyond livestock. So joining us now is Madeline Beck. She is Boise State Public Radio's regional reporter with the Mountain West News Bureau, and she has been talking to numerous farmers and ranchers all over the Mountain West about how COVID-19 has changed their lives. Madeline, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
So Madeline, I know you've talked with potato farmers, you've talked with dairy farmers, you've talked with ranchers. Is the conversation the same, or are they experiencing different issues?
Yeah, it's definitely regionally different, and it's different per product. So what we heard earlier in the hour with hog farms, they are producing constantly. Something like a cattle market, which we see more of here in the Mountain West, is very different. It's more cyclical. A lot of people sell their calves in the fall. So they're going to be impacted in a very different way and at very different times. Obviously, there are still those who were planning on marketing their cattle at this point through livestock auctions like steers and things, but they've been able to hold on to them like some hog farmers might not be able to because they have the space, because a lot of them have rangeland and things like that. So it is hitting this region different, and it's hitting these dairies in like Idaho a lot different because here we have much larger operations than you're seeing in other places. Idaho dairies have actually been a little bit better well off to handle some of the dairy crisis we've seen over the last several years, just because they are so large. But that's kind of hurting them more now because every cow that you're trying to feed and keep under your roof is costing you money now that you're not making back. And obviously, we are seeing these aid packages come out of the federal government. But those, a lot of them are now very concentrated on small operations. So what's kind of helped these larger operations for so long now might actually be hurting them given the pandemic.
So, Madeline, let's talk a little bit about farmers who deal with fruit and vegetable crops, because they're being affected as well.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And so a lot of them, it's a really challenge. Every crop is different and every operation is different. If you have a much smaller operation, some of them are actually seeing an increase in sales. If you have a very small operation that's just based in a community, some people are like, oh, well, I can't find this at my store, but I know this person. So you're actually seeing an increase in very small operations. But when you see those larger operations, yeah, you are seeing these giant mountains of potatoes in Idaho that they're giving away for free. And in some of those instances, it may seem like a lot, but it might only be 10% of their crop, and they might expect to continue it on after this. But yeah, it's really operation to operation, crop to crop. I'd looked into some of the egg shortages that were happening, and it seemed like there were actually enough eggs in the market. But again, it was that repackaging, reprocessing so that they can go to a store instead of a restaurant or something like that.
And that does seem to be what a common theme that we're hearing is it's really hard to make that pivot from, producing for big organizations versus, someone needing to get a dozen eggs at the grocery store. Madeline, stay on the line with us.
And Barney is on the line in Grinnell, Iowa. Hello, Barney.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
The idea of the distribution and the size of the packing plants and such. I mean, we sell some of our meat locally. There are so few lockers anymore that it's hard to get into lockers, and things have got incredibly busy since this happened. I mean, we have customers coming out of the wall. But the idea that we have, because of the lack of antitrust legislation, our packing plants keep getting bigger and bigger. We need more small, regional-sized and smaller size packing plants, distribution, our local grocery store, they couldn't get yeast a year ago. Their distributors told them to forget it. They're not going to get any yeast. This is a reasonable sized grocery store, but because they're small compared to the big chains, the other stores.
Barney, that brings up
distribution is.
Right. That brings up such an important point. And economist Chad Hart, can you respond to that quickly? Because we've talked about a lot about the local foods movement over the last decade or so. And one of the things is that the infrastructure that used to be available to distribute local food to local consumers is just not there. And, Barney's saying he wants to go back to smaller operations. But tell me about that infrastructure, because it's just not available, is it? At least right now.
It's not available, and it's because, if you want to think of it, our food system continues to evolve. And one of the things that has driven it over the past, especially 50, 60 years, is that in food service, there are economies of scale, which typically means the bigger you are, the more efficient you can be, the lower cost you can have, and the more competitive you are. And so that's why we have seen things move from what used to be small and local towards larger national and international corps because of that cost effectiveness of that delivery. In order to maintain that local structure, we end up having to pay a little more. And that's what we are seeing, you know, as we look at the local food movement, for example, is that willingness of some consumers in certain areas to be willing to pay that additional price in order to maintain that local delivery.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see how this develops in the future as the pandemic dissipates. You can join our conversation. Tweet us at Amplified2020.
And you are listening to America Amplified. I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio, along with my co-host Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio. We want to take a call from Fred from Rochester, New York. Fred, this is really interesting. We have had quite a few people call about being vegans and vegetarians, and I'm really curious to hear your take on this food processing and production issues that we are running into right now.
Well, thank you. Eating animal flesh is not an essential part of our diet. We can live very well without it. As a matter of fact, it's linked to a lot of health concerns. High blood pressure, diabetes has been slowed and even reversed in some cases with people going to a plant-based diet. And it's not environmentally friendly to grow animals for food. It's one of the biggest polluters of our environment, more than planes, trains, and automobiles.
So, from multiple directions,
it's not a good process.
So, Fred, have you run into any shortages, though, even eating a more vegetarian diet when you've gone into the grocery store?
Is fairly easy to do, and there are organic growers in Rochester area that are doing a lot online. You can go online. You can order a box of vegetables. You go and, you pay for it ahead of time. You go there, your name's on the box, you pick it up, and you go.
Chad, let's bring you back into the conversation. Chad's an economist at Iowa State University. I mean, Chad, Fred does bring up a good point, right? There are people that do not eat animal products. However, with that being said, there is a large population that does. So how do we balance the two, especially right now, right? I mean, because I would think that, as we mentioned, we're seeing shortages in every facet of the food chain.
We are, and that's the deal. I think as we're looking at sort of this resorting of the food chain we're going through right now, it is figuring out how to address people's wants and needs within the food system while at the same time maintaining flow for everybody out there as far as what they're looking for. I've described what we're doing right now as a massive replumbing of the food system in that we're not only changing what we eat, how we eat it, but sort of how we package it, deliver it, and bring it to folks. And so, as the caller mentioned, the idea of that, for some things, we're able to source those locally from our local farmers and ranchers in the area. For other products, we're having to rely upon that international food chain to deliver it. It's not, here in Iowa, I'm not going to find a banana producer. So I need to figure out, okay, what are the ways that we can get bananas through the food system to deliver it to those areas that can't produce the products that they're looking for?
Well, and that's part of it, right, is that there's so much more than just walking into a grocery store and picking up that banana. It takes a lot more to get it into your hand.
It definitely does. And, when you think about it, it's the steps along the way of not only producing the initial product, but the processing, the packaging, the delivery of that product throughout, our grocery stores and our food system here within the United States.
Chad, thanks so much for your perspective.
We've been also getting several tweets this hour. You can tweet us also at Amplified2020. From Patty Woodbury of Arizona, this should be making us take a hard look at our food supply and how we support those who grow and process our food. Industrial farming of animals or crops is simply not sustainable and shows little respect for the animals slaughtered, the people who process them or process crops. And let's go next to the phones. Eileen is on the line in Orlando, Florida. Hello, Eileen.
Hi. I'd like to echo that last tweet. I feel really strongly about it. And in Orlando, I'm able to find all of my produce, my milk, my meats at local farms that do what one of the men that called in, I think it was Barney, talked about. They do their own local processing of the animals, and I know how they're fed, and I know the farmers personally. Of course, it wouldn't work for large schools and restaurants, but I feel that it is a way a consumer can go straight to the farmer. I do pay more. You did bring that up. I pay $8 for a half a gallon of fresh raw cow's milk. I pay $6 for ground beef. That's probably about average, but I do pay more. I pay $6 for a dozen eggs, but I feel this is a way to support the people who transport and respect people in processing, that they don't have to do an animal within 1 minute. Right. Usually is how fast they have to be processed in
Eileen,
large factory farming.
Thank you so much for sharing your perspective. We are seeing a lot of people responding this way, saying, hey, you know, maybe we are overly dependent on these very inexpensive products that we rely on. We've seen people calling for a boycott of meat from some of these processing plants where workers have been sickened. Chad, our food system is set up in a very specific way to provide us with inexpensive options. How do you see things changing, perhaps, because of this moment in time?
Well, it is set up to provide inexpensive options, but it's also set up to provide safe options as well. But it is also flexible. Like I say, it's always evolving. As Eileen mentioned there, the idea is that we do have consumers that recognize, okay, if they're looking for certain attributes in their food, they want to know where it came from. They want to know that it's locally raised. If you're willing to pay that little extra in order to incentivize that production, the food system adjusts to provide that for you. We do see the growth in local foods movements, in organic production. And again, it's trying to evolve the entire system. So we'll always have what I'll call conventional food production out there, but we'll also see more growth in these specialized food markets in areas where people are willing to invest in their food options.
Well, it will be interesting to see how this develops. Clearly, this is a moment when a lot of people are thinking about something that we usually take for granted in this country. Chad Hart, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Chad Hart is Associate Professor of Economics. He's also a crop market specialist and extension economist at Iowa State University. Also with us this hour, Madeline Beck, Boise State Public Radio's regional reporter with Mountain West News Bureau. And that's all the time we have for this hour. Thank you so much for joining us for America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. You can listen back to this episode at AmericaAmplified.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's show was produced by Caitlin Harrop in Iowa and Frankie Barnhill in Idaho. Special thanks to WABE in Atlanta and KCUR in Kansas City for working together to bring these voices from across the country to your public radio station. Thanks also to the team at America Amplified, a community engagement initiative supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Our technical director is Steven Steigman. Our coordinating producer and director is Andrea Tudhope. And our executive producer is John Haas. And the conversation doesn't end here. You can find us on Twitter at Amplified2020. From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Charity Nebbe in Iowa City.
And I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho. And this is America Amplified. I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho.
And I'm Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Welcome to America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. We're teaming up with public radio stations across the country to talk about how life has changed because of the pandemic.
And this hour, we're talking about mental health. The outbreak of COVID-19 may be stressful for people. Fear and anxiety about a disease can be overwhelming, and it can cause strong emotions, not just in adults, but in children.
We want to hear how you're doing, how you're coping, how your family is coping, and how has life been for you? Tweet us at Amplified2020.
And a quick disclaimer, we are not mental health experts. This conversation is a space for shared experiences, and it should not be taken as medical advice.
If you are experiencing a crisis, please seek professional help. The number for the National Alliance on Mental Illness is 1-800-950-NAMI, that's N-A-M-I, or 1-800-950-6264.
And our first guest today is Chris Edwards, a psychologist with St. Luke's Clinic Behavioral Health Services in Twin Falls, Idaho. Chris, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
You know, Chris, we've heard from so many people all around the country that folks are experiencing loneliness, you know, anxiety. Some folks are dealing with a depression, maybe even, you know, before the pandemic. But this seems to be exacerbating it. What are you hearing in your own community?
Well, I think you pointed some really good things there. I think that the social isolation in itself, I think for most people, has been a bit of a struggle. And we really try to encourage people to sort of, you know, isolate certainly, but don't be socially isolative. In other words, you can isolate but still stay connected, because we're seeing people that are struggling with that, with just the idea of sort of being alone, struggling by themselves, and not sure how to cope with that. Because as human beings, we're naturally social people. When you add on top of that someone who may have some pre-existing conditions or concerns for anxiety or depression, it just makes those things that much more difficult and that much worse. If you're a person who struggles with depression in particular, one of the things we usually encourage people to do who are depressed is to activate themselves. Get out, get doing things, get out in your community, get out in the sunshine, things like that. And with right now, with the messages, stay inside, you know, don't do those things, it actually can have the opposite effect upon what we'd like them to do for the depression, for example. So that can make sometimes things worse. And so we have to work that much harder in looking for ways and creative ways to help them to be able to kind of combat the anxiety and depression that they may already be experiencing.
And you ended up having to close your clinic. I mean, like so many providers did when the coronavirus pandemic hit. Were you concerned about how patients would get the care they needed when you had to close your doors?
Oh, certainly. You know, I think when we think medical care of any kind, in particular mental health care, the first thing that comes to mind is coming into the office, talking to your psychiatrist, your therapist, your psychiatrist, kind of the proverbial, you know, couch, so to speak. That's where you come when you're comfortable talking and opening up and sharing. And so whenever, you know, we think about the concern about closing your doors, that's always a concern, particularly in a rural community like we are in anywhere here in Idaho, actually, much less the Mountain West. Where we have a very low, we don't have enough mental health providers in the first place. Unfortunately, here in Idaho, for example, we're in one of the highest areas of need for behavioral health services and one of the lowest areas in terms of the number of providers that we have available. So when you say things like we have to close the doors because of concern for COVID, it certainly raises a lot of concern in terms of how we're going to reach out and how we're going to help our patients if we can't keep our doors open.
So let's talk a little bit more about that, because we do have telehealth. And in fact, in March, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services actually broadened telehealth services to cover mental health care by phone, which is great in this time. However, as you mentioned, with rural areas, and Idaho is a rural state, there are other areas of the country that have this issue as well. And this is broadband connectivity. So some people may not even be able to access this.
So, you know, great point. You know, the first thing we went to initially asked was what we consider to be kind of virtual health. So when you say virtual health, I'm thinking video. And so that's, you know, probably our next best level of care. Although it's the same level of care, research has shown that, you know, that video health has the same degree of efficiency and efficacy as face-to-face. So that's certainly the first thing we did. And we made some pretty quick changes. And I think all the way across the board, For most mental health clinics across the country, and certainly in the rural areas here at St. Luke's, we quickly stood up virtual care. And you're exactly right in terms of video piece, you know, that's really nice, but we assume again, broadband connectivity, but we have some patients in our area who don't have access to that. It could be because they don't have access to connectivity, or they have just really bad connections. They can't handle the broadband. Or for example, they may not be able to afford to be able to pay a cable bill or an internet bill. So that was a big concern we had, and we were certainly seeing patients, as many providers will across our area, telephonically. But there's a concern when we're seeing a patient telephonically. We certainly are going to do that because it's the right care to have for our patients. But at the same time, there is a concern of how do we keep our doors open when COVID is done. So thank goodness CMS allowed telephonic visits to happen, because that's going to help our patients. That's going to help us to provide the care that we need, and also be able to continue to provide and to be able to pay the bills that it's going to need to be able to continue to. And I'm not just talking St. Luke's. I'm talking, you know, providers in general, private practitioners who have to be able to pay their bills. If they weren't reimbursing for telephonic care, that was going to be a real concern for them. So it was a real blessing that was able to happen.
Chris, this is Charity Nebbe in Iowa. And of course, we have a lot of rural parts of this state, just like Idaho mm-hmm. does. And we have a real scarcity of providers in the rural areas of our state. Mental health mm-hmm. care, a lack of mental health care, is something that we've been struggling with for years. Now, telehealth can hopefully provide a little more access, and we've been working to build that up. But just with a lack of providers, do you think this crisis is deepening in rural parts of the country?
Yes, I think it very much is. It was difficult enough. So in rural areas, I think we have some struggles in addition to some of the things we talked about before. We have struggles in addition to a stigma that continues to be associated with mental health care. The stigma that we're all sort of familiar with of if you're seeking out mental health care, it might mean that's a sign that you're weak, or that you have some difficulties, or it just has that negative stigma associated with it. So people really don't want to seek out mental health care, or many don't. In our rural areas, that stigma is even harsher to a large degree. And so if you make it even harder, or if it is even harder to get in the doors, it just keeps those people away that much more.
And Chris, this is Gemma again from Boise. You know, we've also talked to parents, and I think we as parents are struggling as to what is normal and when should we maybe seek some help for our kiddos right now. For example, I'll just talk to you quickly about my youngest. You know, and as you know, in Twin Falls, we not only did we deal with the pandemic, on March 31st, we had a large earthquake in Idaho. And since that earthquake hit on March 31st, my 8-year-old, every single night, has ended up on the floor in our bedroom sleeping. And this is a regression. I mean, so that's what I'm asking. You know, though, are those the things that we should be worried about? Or when should we as parents say, you know what, we just need to relax for a minute and allow our kids to process too?
Gosh, I'm glad you brought that up. That's such a great concern. You know, I think that as adults, you know, we're all struggling in our own degree with handling with everything that's happening with COVID right now. And just depending on our own individual interpersonal strengths and struggles and areas of concern, it's a struggle for us. For kids, it's even that much harder because, you know, we can maybe sort of process as adults COVID-19. You know, if you think about back in January of this year, you know, we had no concept that anything like this was going to happen. And we heard about this virus somewhere in China. We're like, oh, that's never going to affect us. Because as human beings, we really, and even as children too, we sort of value a sense of control over our lives. We value a sense of safety. And our safety has really been rocked in so many different ways. How many of us would have thought in Iowa or in Idaho, you know, that we'd be, you know, quarantined or you know, on these, you know, stay at home kind of orders that are happening? We would have never considered that. We would have thought, oh, you're crazy. And so here we are as adults dealing with that. And as kids, it's even that much more difficult. And so just on a general level, that thought of what's happening, why can't I go out? If I go out to the stores, I go to Walmart or Target or whatever store, people wearing face masks, what is that all about? Am I okay? Am I safe? Is it dangerous right now? And like you said, then you added that earthquake. I remember that day.
Right.
It makes things even that much. It's like, what else can go wrong? So it made things even that much scarier for us. So I think as kids, right now, everything is out of control. I'm not sure about in Iowa, and I believe so, but you know, here in Idaho, the schools are shut down.
Yeah, they're shut down everywhere.
They're everywhere. Yeah. So, you know, we're homeschooling right now, whether we want to or not. So to add to it, you know, kids are home. They don't get the usual sense of getting out and getting about. So the whole world's kind of tipsy turvy. So the biggest thing for kids right now is trying to get back to a sense of normalcy, trying to get back to a sense of, you know, normalcy in our new world right now. So I think it was a great example, you know, that your child is sleeping on your floor right now. That may be for them right now, the sense of security and safety that they're looking for. Maybe it's a little bit of a regression, but it's a regression back to, gosh, Mom, I don't feel safe, and I feel safe when I'm sleeping on your floor.
Hey, Chris, I'd love for you to stay on the line because sure. We're going to be hearing from some other kids after the break.
Let's go to the phones. Chris is on the line in San Francisco. Hello, Chris.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call and for addressing this topic. I'm a psychologist. I work in substance use disorder treatment, and a very effective device for reducing anxiety is the deep, centered breath. It's something that we're already doing. It activates the vagus nerve, which brings the parasympathetic nervous system. It activates that, and it's calming, soothing, relaxing. It's accessible to anybody, no matter where they are. Can you say something about that?
Oh, Chris, thank you so much for bringing that up. And Chris Edwards, I'll give you 15 seconds to respond to that, but we will continue our conversation after the break.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, obviously, yeah, you know, deep cleansing breaths, I think, is one of the wonderful things we can do. Like she was saying, is, you know, sometimes the biggest thing to do is, how do we calm down our brain and how do we calm down our body at the same time? Sometimes just taking some deep breaths like that will do some wonderful things to help to take control over our life in many different ways.
All right. We will continue this conversation in just a moment. Chris Edwards, psychologist with St. Luke's Clinic Behavioral Health Service in Twin Falls, Idaho. We are talking about mental health during COVID-19, the impact it's having on people, as well as access to mental health care. You can join the discussion. Tweet us at Amplified2020. We will be right back. This is America Amplified. Welcome back. I'm Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City.
And I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho. This is America Amplified, life, community, and COVID-19.
We are talking this hour about mental health during this pandemic. How are you doing? How are your loved ones doing? Kids, maybe the elders in your family. Are you able to get access to mental health care right now? Wherever you are, we want to hear from you. Tweet us at Amplified2020.
And we should say, we are not mental health experts. This conversation, it is a space for shared experiences, and it should not be taken as medical advice.
If you are experiencing a crisis, please seek professional help. The number for the National Alliance on Mental Illness is 800-950-NAMI, 800-950-6264.
You know, most of us have never experienced anything like the coronavirus pandemic in our lifetime, and that is so true for kids. Many are facing all kinds of new stresses and worries, and right now, we're going to hear from a few children in Idaho, Colorado, and Oregon about their mental health.
My name's Olivia. I'm 10 years old. I live in Boise, Idaho. I feel stressed because I feel like I'm putting a lot of pressure on my parents, asking them questions in the middle of like conference calls and stuff. I'll get like really sad and then I'll like yap at them and then I'll feel bad about that and I'll get sad again and it just goes around and around and around.
My name is Jackson Simons. I am 17 and I live in Littleton, Colorado. I've definitely like struggled a little bit off and on with depression. Like, I definitely didn't do much of anything for the first couple weeks, and it was hard to get out of bed. My last season of lacrosse was supposed to be this spring. I've played since second grade, so it was kind of a big last season for me. I've spent a lot of time processing it and grieving it, so I'm doing better with it.
My name is Brennan Johnson. I live in Bend, Oregon, and I am 11. I usually am more of a worried person, but now it's like, there's a lot more bigger, badder things going on. Yeah, and it's been, like, hard to sleep, and I can't quite, like, turn my brain off.
My name's Eleanor, and I'm 10 years old. I live in Portland and I'm in fourth grade. It's a little weird trying to stay home. I would prefer to play with all my friends or be running around the neighborhood like a wild cat. So I guess I'm kind of worried, like, if my dad gets the virus, because my dad has multiple sclerosis, and there's more of a chance he would be dying.
I'm Emerson, and I live on Virginia Avenue, Boise, Idaho. I'm 6 years old. I have two moms. It's sad to have corona, because then we can't see our teachers and our friends. I'm afraid it might come to me and get me, and it's scary to die because you don't know what it's going to feel like. It's okay to have this big change in my life because then I get to be with my family.
And that audio diary came to us from Amanda Peacher of the Mountain West News Bureau. You know, you can call us and be a part of the conversation, 800-444-8642. Charity, you and I are both moms. And, you know, we are dealing with this on the daily basis as well, right? Our kiddos are out of school physically, still going to school. You know, I mentioned my 8-year-old having issues with sleeping. My 12-year-old tomorrow, it's his birthday tomorrow. That's the thing. Celebrating his birthday in quarantine, right? Yeah. And having to tell them, like, you know what, when there's a time we can get together with your friends. But, you know, this year it's mom and dad and your brother. So, yay. Well, but it's, you know, how kids are dealing with that.
Right. And my kids are 12 and 14, so they're a little bit older. And they understand what's going on in the world, but they still have their own personal sorrows. And sometimes as a mom, that's something that I have to remind myself mm-hmm. of is, you know, the fact that you don't get to see your friends or these high school seniors who don't get to go to prom, right? Don't get to graduate. Now, that may seem very small when you think about how many people are suffering and dying from this virus, but it's big in their lives. And that grief is real. That isolation that my kids are experiencing, it's greater than the isolation that I experience because they really are home all the time. They don't have a job where they interact with other people. They are just stuck there.
And beyond that, you know, I know, like, with my 8-year-old in particular, that loneliness, because he's not necessarily interacting with his friends because we don't let him play online with friends. My 12-year-old has found that connection with his friends. But then it's that idea of technology, right? We're letting them on electronics so much more. So there's right. so many questions as parents. And if you were dealing with that, too, or if you are concerned about your mental health, a loved one's mental health, tweet us at Amplified2020.
And Paul is on the line in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hello, Paul.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. What would you like to talk about?
Yes. I'm wondering, I have 3 little grandchildren, and they're witnessing the fear that their parents have and all of these issues concerning the coronavirus. What do you think are going to be the long-term effects on the psyche of these children from having experienced really what is mostly their parents' fear?
Yeah, Paul, I think that is such a terrific question. And Chris Edwards, psychologist with St. Luke's Clinic Behavioral Health Services in Twin Falls, Idaho, is still with us. Chris, what do you think? What are possibly the long-term consequences of living through this pandemic and experiencing all of this fear for children?
You know, I guess a wonderful question. You know, I guess something that we kind of think about. You know, I think for our generation and the generation for these kids coming up right now, in particular, it sounds like probably your grandchildren's age. This is probably the most striking thing that touches them personally. You know, and I think a lot of it has to do with really how we talk to them about it, how we work through this with them about it. We do know that the big word that we use a lot of times that you hear is resilience. Resilience is a phrase we use in psychology a lot that refers to someone who has the ability to get through difficult times in their life and stressful situations and come out on the other end in a positive way. What we found is that people who are able to do that, children, adults, are those that have an attitude towards things in life, like things like this, as a challenge in terms of how am I going to get through this, as opposed to I can never get through this. You know, how can I, you know, if we can work with our kids in terms of teaching them that difficult things in life can happen, But there are things that we can work through, things that we can make our way through, and there's a positive light at the end of the tunnel. If we work with them as this is a challenge, and this is something, though, that's not insurmountable, and something that we can take control over, taking control over meaning doing the things that we can do to overcome this, taking the time that we can do. If it's, you know, talking about it once or twice a day, then turning that topic off. If it's getting in out and taking control back over our lives by taking control of our schedule, taking control of the activities that we can do, doing those things can teach children that even sometimes things that are incredibly difficult and stressful are things that can be taken control of and that can be overcome. Those are big things that have a difference to do with how kids will do with things long term.
Chris, this is Gemma from Boise State Public Radio. So quickly, also, I think it's important to talk about how we talk to our children based on their ages. Because as we heard in that audio diary, that little six-year-old from mm-hmm. Boise saying, I'm afraid it's going to get me, right? Mm-hmm. So what about that age appropriateness of talking about this? Because I don't think we should be hiding this from our children either.
No, I think it's a great point. You know, I think you're exactly right. And listening to some of those kids, you know, kind of makes you smile, kind of makes you tear up when you hear the different things that they said. But yeah, you know, I think age appropriateness, you know, is talking about, you know, what are we talking about? Like a six-year-old, we're talking about, well, you know what, there's a sickness that's going around. That's something that's affecting people. And we're going to do our best here at home to keep everybody happy. You know, keep everybody safe. We're going to wash our hands. We're going to do these different things. And that's on a basic level for a really young child, really all they need to know. You know, for as kids get older, you know, maybe they start to get in their, you know, tweeners or early teens, you can talk a little bit more about what is this virus? What is a virus? How does a virus work? How does it, you know, get into your body? But at the same time, we're still stressing the same things that we can do to control it. We're washing our hands. We're wearing a mask. We're doing all these things that help us to maintain control to keep healthy. Obviously, later teenagers, we can talk a lot more about maybe the impact. Could it impact grandma or grandpa? Could it impact, you know, the right. one child said, my dad has multiple sclerosis. Could it impact? Then we can talk about, yes, maybe it could. And this is how. But we don't want to talk about those things a whole lot with younger kids. It's just too scary.
Chris, we want to keep you on the line in case sure. we have some other questions coming in. If you would like to join the conversation, you can tweet us at Amplified2020.
Thank you, Gemma. Charity Nebbe with Iowa Public Radio here with my co-host Gemma Gaudette in Boise, Idaho. And our next guest is Daniel Finney. He is a longtime journalist, most recently at the Des Moines Register. He's also struggled for many years with depression and anxiety, and he's been very open about those struggles as a journalist and a blogger. He is with us on the line. Hello, Daniel.
Greetings.
Thank you so much for being here. And you have been so open about your life with mental health issues. For people who aren't familiar with this story, just briefly tell us about how you have struggled with depression and anxiety.
I had a collection of adverse childhood experiences. I was born a ward of the state and had a very difficult childhood with my adoptive mother in particular, and though my childhood stabilized, the bad thinking patterns that develop from some of those experiences have extended well into adulthood. They include diagnoses of chronic depression and acute anxiety issues and obesity and some other side effects that we work to manage daily.
Now, as we've just been talking about, this pandemic is a lot to deal with for everyone, with this anxiety and fear, with heartbreaking story after heartbreaking story in the news. And then also, on top of that, for so many Americans, job loss or layoffs, food insecurity, fears about being able to pay the bills. And that's part of your story as well. Your position was just cut from the Des Moines Register, so you're also experiencing job loss in this moment. How are you coping?
Well, I appreciate the national platform to let everyone know I'm looking. but the truth is, it is pretty terrifying. The goal for me is to manage anxiety. Because what goes into your mind is, I'm a newspaper reporter, and it's been the apocalypse for newspapers for a long time. And now I've lost my job in the economic apocalypse that comes along with coronavirus. And it is scary to look at job boards and see the postings are 30 days old and know that industries that might that I might be successful in, other than journalism and potential journalism opportunities, are all sort of like, well, got to see how this thing plays out. And there's only so many weeks of you know, severance pay and so many weeks of unemployment. And so to manage the anxiety part of that, the mental health part of that, is it's a daily struggle not to go from I'm 5 seconds away from being broke, dead in a gutter somewhere here in Des Moines, and just work through the fact that, well, what you can apply for a job today, or you can look at things, and you won't always, you won't be able to solve all problems today. But it's super scary, and that's natural. And what the hard part is separating what's natural, being scared and being unemployed, and being unemployed during the coronavirus period, and what is amplified by anxiety disorder, which are chemical malfunctions in the brain that make something way worse than it is. Then again, how could it get much worse? So right. I don't know.
So, and Daniel, I know that you see a therapist regularly. Has that changed during this period? I mean, offices are closed. How are you getting mental health care treatment?
It has. I am still seeing my therapist twice a month. We tried, I heard Dr. Chris talking about it, we tried the Zoom conferencing, and I hated it. National Geographic had a really interesting article about how Zoom conferences are actually more stressful for some people based on the way that we process visual cues and the way that the technology leaves it so it looks like we're not actually looking at each other, but we're looking at each other looking at cameras, and all kinds of stuff. But I just didn't like it. I was distracted by it. And so the second session that I've had in quarantine, we just did by phone, and I found that to be a much more intimate and better experience between my therapist and I.
And Daniel, we have just a moment here. I'm curious if you have some brief advice for people. We were talking earlier about the stigma of mental health, the difficulty of asking for help when you need it. What would you tell someone who is struggling, maybe somebody who's never struggled before?
I would remind everybody that mental health is physical health. And if you had a toothache, you would not hesitate to ask a dentist for help. And if you had angina, you would not hesitate to ask a cardiologist for help. And there's no thing about your, there's nothing about your emotions that's different from that. I agreed with Dr. Chris had mentioned something about the stigma in rural Iowa. And I think that is not only all too real, it's terrible. Because, you know, all of the emotions that we feel let me put it a different way. The brain isn't magic. It's another organ, just like your heart or your pancreas. And if you have high blood pressure, that's a problem that could be fatal. And if you have diabetes, that's a problem that could be fatal. And so can anxiety and depression. So seek treatment. And be kind to yourself and let yourself be sad and or be scared in the moment, but don't let it dominate every moment of your day.
Well, Daniel Finney, thank you so much for talking with me. Daniel Finney, longtime journalist, most recently with the Des Moines Register. He's also struggled for many years with depression and anxiety. He's been very open about those struggles, both as a journalist and as a blogger. We're talking about mental health today. Here's a tweet from someone in Eastern Iowa who says, I've been fortunate to be able to access therapists via Zoom meetings and increase my sessions to twice per week. I have PTSD, so this increase in therapy and being able to focus more on processing trauma has accelerated my healing. Mindfulness has been absolutely necessary to navigate my emotional responses to the pandemic. Thank you so much for sharing that perspective.
And we are continuing the conversation. If you would like to be a part of it, tweet us at Amplified 2020. When we come back, we will be talking with a therapist from the Nez Perce Reservation in Idaho. You're listening to America Amplified. We will be back right after this. Welcome back. I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho.
And I'm Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. This is America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. And this hour, we're talking about mental health. We want to know how you're doing, how your loved ones are doing. Can you get access to mental health care right now? Tweet us at Amplified 2020.
And a disclaimer very quickly, we are not mental health experts. This conversation, it is a place to share your experiences. Do not take this as medical advice, please.
And if you are experiencing a crisis, please seek professional help. The number for the National Alliance on Mental Illness is 800-950-NAMI or 800-950-6264.
And our next guest is therapist Myra Campbell. She works at the Nemiapu Health Clinic on the Nez Perce Reservation in Idaho. She is also a member of the Nez Perce tribe. Myra, thanks so much for joining the conversation.
Yes. Hi, ladies. How are you today?
We're good. Myra, the Nez Perce tribe, if people don't know, you are a tight-knit community. And I understand that just last week you actually saw your first confirmed cases of COVID-19. How are people handling that news?
Well, I think there's just a mixed emotions from amongst people here on the reservation. It all comes down to, I think, some in denial or disbelief that this could be happening to us. So there's a lot of uncertainty and frustration going on. There's some anger emotions going on, a little bit of anxiety and depression are normal for most people. But yes, it has been something that I think we're all aware of right now. And I think we're being a little bit more conscientious of that.
For people who aren't aware where the Nez Perce Reservation is, it is located in a rural part of north central Idaho. I mean, it is literally surrounded by national forest land on one side. And then according to the FCC, there are just not a lot of options for broadband internet in your area. I bring that up because are you experiencing less people coming to therapy sessions because they can't make video conferencing work? Or as we heard in our last segment from Daniel, they don't like that.
Yeah, I've heard that. And I've heard that, too, that most people feel like it's impersonal to see somebody on a camera. And it is true, like he said, some people just like to talk on the phone. So it's been sort of half and half. There's some people that have taken to the social media and doing it through Zoom or FaceTime or something of the other to be able to talk to somebody about their mental health issues. Whereas some have just said, I'll call you when I need you. And we'll wait till the COVID-19 and everything is done with. And then I will resume my therapy then.
Myra, if you'd stay on the line, we would love that to get back to you a little bit later. If you would like to join the conversation, we'd love to know how you're doing, what your concerns are when it comes to mental health, maybe access, maybe having to maybe deal with maybe a little bit of depression, anxiety. Tweet us at Amplified 2020.
And let's go now to Amy on the line in Dallas, Texas. Hello, Amy.
Hello.
Hi. Tell us your story.
Well, I'm an older person. I'm 67, and I've just been going through a lot. I lost my job, can't get through the unemployment, just things after things. I didn't have water for a month, And then I just all these things have just piled up, and it's just like overwhelming. And I know a lot of other older people like myself who have been going through the same things, and we're just struggling with just trying to cope and just function, you know, because it's a hard thing just to get out of bed some days.
Absolutely. Well, and being an older person, a member of a group that's at such high risk with COVID-19, does that amplify your anxiety, do you feel?
It does, because I live alone, so I have to go to the grocery store myself. And that's anxiety prone in itself. I just go in there, rush in, get what I need, and come right out. You know, it's just like scary.
Amy, is anything helping you?
Well, I've had some friends who've helped me out, who've, you know, having a little bit of a support system. I mean, because, well, you know, people usually are with other people, and so they forget about us people who are all by ourselves. So you have to reach out sometimes, I guess, and just try to talk to somebody and say, I'm having a hard day.
Yeah. Amy, thank you so much for sharing your experience, and please take care. You can join our conversation as well. 800-444-8652. You can also tweet us at Amplified2020.
And you're listening to America Amplified. I'm Gemma Gaudet from Boise State Public Radio, along with my co-host Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio, talking this hour about mental health. Our next guest is Guns in America's Heath Druzan. He is a reporter based at Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho. One of the topics that Heath covers is a rise in death by suicide in the Mountain West, where suicide is already a big problem. And we want to be really clear that data supports talking openly about suicide, or whether people are thinking about suicide, as being helpful. It will not trigger or inspire people to make an attempt. We want to be clear about that. It is necessary to talk about this. Also, if you are experiencing a crisis right now, that number to call, 800-273-TALK, 800-273-TALK. Heath, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Hey, in your reporting, what are you hearing about calls to crisis lines?
What I'm hearing from experts who are both local in Idaho and some national experts around the country is that call volume has been kind of mixed, but there's been a real big increase in a lot of the sort of COVID hotspots around the country. But what seems to be pretty consistent is that the kinds of calls that they're getting have really changed. There's a lot more sort of pandemic-specific calls. Folks are calling, you know, because they lost their jobs, because they have anxiety, you know, about COVID-19, and, you know, just the general sort of economic state of the country right now. I mean, we all know that this has been, you know, pretty disastrous for a lot of folks economically. So what's been interesting talking to these experts is just how the nature of the calls to crisis lines has really changed as this pandemic has worsened.
So besides calling in with those concerns about anxiety and job security, is there anything else that these experts are telling you that people are calling in about?
Well, you know, anybody who's familiar with the term social distancing, and I don't know anyone who couldn't be familiar with that term, unfortunately, right now, since that is sort of our reality, they know that what this has done to American life has really kind of separated us. And there are folks who are particularly isolated. Maybe these are folks who live alone, and, you know, they might have visitors, and they might have family members come in regularly, and now they're kind of cut off from that human contact. So that is a concern that a lot of experts have, that there are folks who might be more isolated. And, you know, this can be anyone, but certainly older folks are more susceptible to that. That isolation and the sense of the uncertainty about the timeline of when we are going to be able to have more human contact, that is something that experts are telling me is a real concern of theirs, and that they really encourage people to, you know, reach out and make that call and talk to loved ones who might be on their own, or even if they're not on their own, who just might be cut off from folks that they, you know, they see regularly under normal circumstances.
Well, we've been talking with Heath Drusen, reporter based at Boise State Public Radio, with Guns and America. Heath, thanks for your time. And Chris Edwards, a psychologist with St. Luke's Clinic Behavioral Health Services in Twin Falls, Idaho. Chris, Heath mentioned social isolation. Our last caller, Amy, talked about that, about living alone. How important is it for people to find some type of social connection right now?
Gosh, it's hugely important. You know, I think what we can look at is how to, you know, if we, for example, had friends that we would regularly reach out to or go on lunch things or just meet for things like that, you know, continue to do those things. You know, for example, if you used to go into, for example, my wife goes to lunch every Thursday with her friends, or every Wednesday. And what they're doing is they're still trying to reach out and get some way to connect. They're having, you know, they're going out and doing a picnic outside, you know, and so of course, where it's social distancing, they can get away. They're still spending time together. They've even joked and talked about, maybe we'll just go to the parking lot, you know, where we go to and park, you know, 6 feet away, but still kind of have those relationships. I think it's important to continue to do those things. We just have to be creative in how we do it. You know, if you have a friend you get together with, get a way to get together, make a phone call, do a FaceTime chat, do something that still allows those relationships to happen. I think, unfortunately, we have to work harder to make it happen, but I just can't encourage enough how important it is to continue to be socially distant, but not distance ourselves socially from others at the same time.
Yeah, such a good point to make. If you would like to join the conversation here on America Amplified, it is easy to do. You can call us right now, 800-444-8652. You can also tweet us at Amplified2020.
This is Charity Nebbe in Iowa with Iowa Public Radio with Gemma Gaudette in Boise, Idaho. And let's go now to Jacob. He's on the line in Lawrence, Kansas. And Jacob, thank you so much for calling. You are a COVID-19 survivor. Tell us your story.
Yes, I had COVID-19. I've been out about 2 weeks, and I still was running a fever at just under a fever of 99.1. And I live alone, and I self-isolated and got through everything. I used a CPAP machine that I have as a respirator, which actually did help. And I iced my head the entire time. I've had anxiety issues for a while now, but I actually just anxiety over I used to work in Kansas, Arizona, and that's on the Navajo reservation, and I worry about fellow coworkers that I worked with there, and my sisters are nurses, and I have a cousin who's a doctor, and they helped me through the whole process. But My mental health issues are more of things that I can't control, as far as how people are reacting to the virus, with lack of using masks. And I took a walk the other day, and I was laughed at and ridiculed for wearing a mask.
Wow.
And that. This is, it hurts.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard enough when you live alone and you have to go through that, but you shouldn't have to be ridiculed for doing the right thing. And my wearing mask was not, to prevent from getting it, but from spreading it.
Yeah, Jacob, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing your story, Jacob. And please take care. I want to ask Chris to join our conversation here again. Chris, Jacob has been through an incredible physical ordeal. He's not alone. Of course, survivors of COVID-19, so many of them have been through so much, including being on ventilators and hospitals and trying to reintegrate into life afterward. People are often afraid to talk about the fact that they've had COVID-19. We've talked about the mental health stigma. There seems to be a stigma attached to getting the virus. virus as well, even though it's so common and so many people have had it. Jacob's really struggling here. Chris, what do you think we can do to support people who've been through this kind of ordeal?
You know, I think there's a couple of things. One is certainly, Jacob, you know, I'm very impressed and so proud that you were willing to call in. That takes a lot of courage on your part to do that and to share the struggles that you're having. You know, I think one of the things we can do is to show the courage that Jacob's showing is to, when we're going out in public, you know, use those things that we should be doing, practicing the behavior that we should be doing so that, first off, we're not spreading it. And second, also someone like Jacob who suffered and is actually trying to help other people, sharing the courage that he has. I think those are things that we can do to share that. I don't want to say share that burden, but share that courage with Jacob. Those are things that we can do to help him out and help others that have been in that same situation.
Jacob, thanks again for calling and sharing your story, and please be well.
We want to go to Rachel now in Iowa. And Rachel, talk to us a little bit about what you're experiencing.
Well, I just wanted to say I too suffer from a mental illness, and I too wear a mask, and I say wear a mask. But anyway, in Iowa, we have just privatized Medicaid. Now, I learned through public policy, you know, that they don't really cut services. They just reduce eligibility. So now we have a lot of people who can't get the treatment they used to have because they aren't sick enough, even though they were before. And other things like one of the main psychiatric in the hospital, they moved the psychiatric doctors to another area where people with mental illness will not be able to access. And even if they could access them, they would have to be referred by a doctor that works in this hospital. And they don't take Medicaid patients. So that's all I wanted to add.
Well, Rachel, we appreciate you calling in and talking to us about this. It's, you know, it's people like you who are willing to say that you suffer from mental illness that is the only way we're going to break that stigma. And Chris, getting back to you very quickly, I mean, we need people like Rachel and Jacob to be saying, yes, I live with mental health issues, because we need to see people functioning in the world.
Yes, exactly. I think, you know, we've talked a little bit about the stigma associated with mental health, and I think we have to be willing to share and be open and have the courage to say, I struggle with mental health. I work with people with mental health issues, because, you know, the estimates of the number of people who have different types of mental health issues is quite high. And if you looked around you, you'd be surprised how many people who are struggling with mental health illness. But I think if we were more willing to be open and reduce that stigma, people, I think as people who may or may not struggle with mental illness, we have to be willing to be open to that and be willing to talk about it, so it isn't so scary to want to, you know, to be willing to open that up to others and be afraid of ridicule.
Chris, I want to thank you so much for taking time today to talk to us. Chris Edwards is a psychologist with St. Luke's Clinic Behavioral Health Services in Twin Falls, Idaho. We were also speaking with Heath Drusen, a reporter based at Boise State Public Radio News, and Myra Campbell, a therapist at the Nez Perce Reservation in Northern Idaho, as well as Daniel Finney, a journalist and someone who talks so openly about his mental health struggles. That is all the time we have today. Thank you so very much, all of you, for joining us this hour for America Amplified, for calling in, for talking to us about your stories. This has been America Amplified Life, Community, and COVID-19. You can listen back to this episode at AmericaAmplified.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's show was produced by Caitlin Harrop in Iowa and Frankie Barnhill in Idaho. Special thanks to WABE in Atlanta and KCUR in Kansas City for working together to bring these voices from across the country to your public radio station. Thanks also to the team at America Amplified, a community engagement initiative supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Our technical director is Steven Steigman. Our coordinating producer and director is Andrea Tudhope. And our executive producer is John Haas. And the conversation doesn't end here. You can find us on Twitter at Amplified2020. From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Charity Nebbe in Iowa City.
And I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho. And this is America Amplified.